Hold on to your face masks, it's time for another Flat Chat. And with the October issue of GP Racing magazine hitting the newsstands today, already having impacted subscribers' doormats, we ask if the clock is ticking on Red Bull's ambition for Max Verstappen to be Formula One's youngest ever world champion. Joining me, Stuart Codling, to discuss that Max Verstappen and other F1 matters of moment are Mark Gallagher, live from Oxfordshire. Is it Oxfordshire or Buckinghamshire? We established last time.
No, it's sunny Oxfordshire, I'm very pleased to
Oxfordshire.
Say. Oxfordshire, yes.
Before the storm clouds roll in and the Atlantic storm fronts. And then heading down Horsham way, hello Ben Anderson.
Hello. Well, not quite Horsham. Close. Lingfield.
Let's take a look at what Helmut Marko said many months ago, when the only bad thing to happen in 2020 was the Craig David New Year's Eve party. He was describing making Max the youngest champion in Formula One history as our big goal.
Helmut Marko, interesting guy. I've been watching a lot of him recently because of the Jochen Rindt 50th anniversary, and seeing a little bit of humanity there, which is kind of unexpected when it comes to Dr. Marko, because he's known to be a pretty hard, tough guy. I was interested to see if he actually got emotional when he was talking about the whole Rindt thing. And he didn't actually get to emotion, but he at least got to kind of talking about what it was that had got him involved in this sport. And actually, you begin to understand that what we I think read as his toughness these days, it just comes from a lifelong passion to be successful in this business. And you know, he's very earnest about it in a very, can I say, Austrian way, kind of straight talking way. I think he kind of supercharges the straight talkingness that we've seen in the past from people like Niki Lauda and also from Toto and Günther Steiner and others. So you know, I think, you know, Helmut's dare I say it, something of an icon that we maybe take slightly for granted.
I think you navigated the turbulent waters of cultural stereotyping quite well there, Mark. That was
good. Well, he's very keen on young Max, isn't he, Helmut? You know, he's been enraptured with him since he first met him when Max was, 17 in Formula 3, duffing people up around the Norris Ring. And it seemed like all the youngest to win this, that and the other records were going to tumble easily at Max's feet when he first got into Formula 1, obviously winning that race in Barcelona for Red Bull at the start of his second season. But things have kind of slipped time, which has become this kind of strange, nebulous concept during the coronavirus pandemic, actually has caught up with him a little bit and with Red Bull. Because this kind of season after season of relentless Mercedes dominance, coupled with, I think, Red Bull not really quite being able to hit the mark on the chassis side anymore, probably in conjunction with the fact that they're overreaching a bit, trying to make up for a lack of power from their various engine partners, means that Max is going to miss that target. I mean, he celebrates his 23rd birthday at the end of this month. By my calculation, to beat Sebastian Vettel's record for youngest world champion, which he did at 23 years and 134 days, I think it says in Andrew Benson's feature, Max would need to be world champion by basically winter testing next year, February time. So that means he has to win it this year. And of course, based on the races we've had so far, that isn't looking very likely. So Max is not likely to become F1's youngest world champion, which means Helmut Marko's stated aim, which looked like an easy win, is not going to happen.
Do we think that car's too hard to drive?
I think that's a consequence of what I was saying before about Red Bull trying so hard to make up for the power deficiency and take on Mercedes. I mean, Christian Horner said they went through, I think, 6 iterations of development during the lockdown period when the season was delayed, before they got to the first race, and tied themselves in knots. And they've been trying to unpick that. But I think even if they've overreached slightly, particularly this season, I think the car becoming more difficult to drive is just a function of having to chase more and more chassis performance to make up for the fact that no one can hold a candle to Brixworth.
I mean, Cyril Abiteboul has said recently that, you know, Red Bull may have missed a trick in terms of the way they've developed their team. And integrating chassis and engine design, you know, within, you know, in-house is such an important facet of being competitive in Formula One these days. And I think Helmut, you know, when we talk about Helmut Marko and his sort of forecast for Max, I mean, going back to my earlier point, I think that Helmut's very passionate about racing. He believes strongly in the ability of an individual driver to make a step forward for the team. He really sees the driver as quite an important differentiator. And people have even been saying recently, you know, did he see a kind of mini Jochen Rindt in Max, you know, someone who was just, he would just go for it. And it was a little bit rough around the edges to begin with, but ultimately has the speed there which developed. But let's introduce a kind of a broader thought process around this, you know, because Helmut's no spring chicken. You know, he's in his 70s. Formula One has changed enormously. We all know that. Andrew Green, technical director at Racing Point, was saying recently in the Formula One podcast that the sport is a completely different discipline today from what it was when he came in the 1990s. It's just night and day difference. You now employ experts on specific components and technologies within your departments. And I think really the complexity of Formula One in order to take on and beat Mercedes-Benz is such a tall order. One actually wonders whether a Formula One team, which has an external engine supplier, can ever produce the fully integrated, holistic package that you need to be the best in this business. Last year in Singapore, I had the privilege of going in to see Lewis's car in the garage, and all the bodywork was off. And it had been a while before I'd stood up close and personal to a naked Formula One car. And it just blew my mind, the degree of integration. And I looked at it and I thought, you know, considering how complex a powertrain is and the overall design, having run Cosworth and knowing what teams were asking for back in 2010, 11 and 12, you know, so many teams were still thinking, well, we just need to know the engine size and shape and mounting points and fuel system and oil system and coolers and all that kind of stuff. But it's so much more than that. And so the level of design integration, I wonder, is it requires a relationship with your engine provider of a level which I actually wonder can anyone possibly do unless it's all under one roof. And so I'm not saying Helmut's out of touch, but what I'm saying is that our sport has definitely moved on, and Mercedes keep proving that they've got the right formula. And despite the best efforts of Red Bull, Honda, I mean, they're essentially the second quickest team in Formula One. Still a massive achievement, but not good enough for Max. Not good. It shouldn't be good enough for Red Bull, and it probably isn't good enough for Dietrich Mateschitz, who owns it. I mean, he's not there to make up the numbers. And this is then sort of leads me into a final point on the whole Red Bull picture, which is, and I really hope Christian and Adrian aren't listening to the podcast when I say this, but one wonders, after, you know, 15 years of the same leadership, is there any form of creeping, I'm not call it complacency. I won't use the C word. It's not complacency. But is there any form of creeping belief actually within Red Bull that of the way they do things that maybe needs a correction? Maybe it needs a little bit of lateral thinking. Now, Adrian Newey, in his book, you know, How to Build a Car, talks about the importance of getting ideas from people. And I think he has an extremely good approach to incentivizing the people who work for him to innovate great technologies into the car. But fundamentally, they've still got this big chunky thing that's made by Honda, which actually these days accounts for so much of the vehicle design and then its subsequent performance. So I wonder if there's a combination of, you know, does Red Bull need, do Adrian and Christian need to bring in some more additional talent and also sit down and talk to Honda about the fact that we can't do 1 year and 2 year deals and extensions. We, you know, you're either in this to win or you're not. And if you're in it to win, maybe we need to bring things closer together and effectively be under one roof, dare I say, joint venture, needs to take it to another level.
Cyril, a few years ago, or at least he says that way back when, sort of in the middle of the previous decade, he had actually gone to the management of Red Bull Racing and suggested closer integration between Renault and Red Bull. And he didn't get it. They weren't prepared to bite down on that, and that was among the reasons for Renault establishing its own Formula One program and buying back Team Enstone. So, you know, if there's any truth in that, you know, it could just be Cyril blowing hot air, but it could be one of those.
It's a complicated situation, isn't it? I know that when Renault was supplying Red Bull, at times Red Bull would do work on the Renault engine. I remember they did a fix on the MGK for the start of the 2017 season, and that was handled by Red Bull rather than by Viri. So there was some collaboration, but it's certainly in the hybrid era all to do with kind of meeting challenges and papering over cracks, whereas obviously in the V8 era, where the engines were simpler and the technology more established and everything more close in terms of performance between different manufacturers, they could then focus on collaborating on particular innovations where the engine could help the chassis. And Red Bull have always insisted, well, that's their area of expertise. They don't want to set up an engine program in-house and invest all the capital you'd need to do that. So they're reliant then on a partner supplier. At the same time, you've got to invest in your own tools. And I think teams can get very stuck in their own bubble. If you look at McLaren and how long they felt like they had world-leading infrastructure, and now finally they've got a leadership team in place that goes, we're way out, we need a new wind tunnel, we need to do this, we need to do that. Red Bull, have they been able to make sufficient upgrades to their tools? I mean, their cars consistently since 2017 have started the season badly, and there've been problems with correlation and some of the concepts not working aerodynamically. They get on top of it. They're still a fantastic team at adding parts to the car, running the car, fixing the car, strategy, fantastic drivers, particularly Max, but maybe not all the pieces of the puzzle are quite in place. And then you've got this cultural element, which I think is more important than maybe the physicality of having everything under one roof. I mean, Brixworth and Brackley, they're close in proximity, but they're not the same building. But that team in Mercedes works as one. The engine department works with the aero department, with the design office. They all compromise with each other to come up with the best overall solution. If they need more cooling, then the engine department will add in an element to help that side of things. If they need more power for qualifying, then maybe they'll make a sacrifice on the aero side, and they just work out what the best overall solution is. But I feel like the other teams in Formula One, whether they've got an engine department in a different country, in the same building, or just down the road, they're not quite able to work in that same joined up way as Mercedes, and that's ultimately, I think, what's holding Red Bull and Honda back. They might get there, but obviously they're in a quite young partnership, and it will take so many years, while all the time Mercedes are continuing to move and raise the bar, which makes it an extraordinary challenge. I think, Mark, maybe you're right. It almost seems like, unless something breaks up the Mercedes dream team, which maybe we're starting to see with Andy Cowell moving on and possibly Toto Wolff moving upstairs, there's going to be no arrest of momentum in that juggernaut. And that's really what Formula One needs. It needs Mercedes to kind of hit the skids itself, and while the other teams keep maintaining their own momentum, which maybe they don't actually have at the moment.
Yeah, it's really, these are really big points, and I think the thing that maybe people should be a little bit frightened of is that because Formula One has become so complex, it's no longer a sport defined by the individual abilities of one or two people. It's not a sport where your Patrick Head comes along and designs a car and goes and wins a world championship. It's a sport where hundreds of people come together and they create a solution. And it is about people with great processes and systems in place. So the ultimately, to get the best Formula One car in the world, you need a set of processes and systems that get you there. It's not about individual people. Certainly, individual leaders can create the right atmosphere within a team to enable that. But ultimately, I think, for example, Mercedes-Benz in Brixworth, they will not miss a beat with Andy Cowell moving on, because the people who have moved in to take over his position, which has now been split up, they've all worked there for over a decade. And I know some of the engineers in there, they're ex-Cosworth people. And, you know, they're not going to miss a beat because there's not one guy sitting in an office upstairs. I think the dynamic in the Formula One team may change a little bit if Toto Wolff moves into an executive chairmanship position or something like that. But in James Allison, he's got someone who is absolutely ripe for the job, if not team principal, then from a chief technical position, able to lead things forward. But, you know, it's interesting, Stuart, go back to your point about Cyril Abiteboul saying that Renault had approached Red Bull previously. You know, to mention Cosworth again, I passionately believe that Red Bull should have bought Cosworth. And in buying Cosworth, they would have had all the capability to create the internal combustion engine, the ICE, no question about that. The ability to develop or indeed buy in the hybrid systems. So, you know, battery and control unit was all there. I mean, you could have gone into partnership with someone like Williams, for example, for the battery technology, and created your own power unit. And then, of course, actually sold power units as a customer to customer teams. You could have had a Cosworth branded hybrid power system, which was fully owned by Red Bull and developed exclusively for them, and then sold that. And of course, that then generates revenue streams for you. So there was a very elegant opportunity there. But going back to Helmut, I mean, I happen to know that he always had a problem with Cosworth. And, you know, when I joined Cosworth, I remember some of the folks telling me, you know, that he used to collar them and say the most outrageous things to them about Cosworth being a sort of an underperforming engine intentionally, that they would somehow try to screw Red Bull over with their V10 engines and back in the day and all that kind of stuff. And that's unfortunate because, you know, people in racing who are ambitious, they don't go around trying to figure out if they're going to underperform. They're trying to do the best job they can. So I think maybe some of Helmut's antipathy towards some of the potential opportunities that could have been there with Red Bull, and when you consider the proximity of Milton Keynes to Northampton, how elegant that would have been for Red Bull. But, you know, so when people say Red Bull didn't want to go to all the expense of setting up an engine division and all that, they didn't need to do that. They could have bought a company for actually not a great deal of money and had an immediate access to so many of the technologies that I think would help them to ultimately get control over their own destiny. And I can imagine that in a private moment, I'm sure Adrian or Christian will admit that while the Honda partnership is great, there is inevitably a little bit of a cultural barrier there. And also there's a commitment barrier because no one quite knows how long they're in for. And I think in that respect, we're seeing that Honda politically hasn't quite moved to the level that it needs to be at as a car manufacturer that wants to win in Formula One. You need to make a very long-term commitment in order to do that. And so far, we haven't really seen that level of understanding coming from Tokyo.
And that's the massive problem for Red Bull, isn't it? They're kind of in a corner because they've fallen out with Renault. Mercedes engines are off the table and have been for some time. And in fact, were taken off the table the last time Red Bull fell out with Renault. Ferrari engines you wouldn't want at the moment, really, let's face it, even if they were offered. So Honda... This time last year, maybe, but not now. There are no new manufacturers coming in. That's not going to happen until the new rules come in, what, 2025, which is, you know, eons away, really, isn't it? So they need the Honda thing to work. And of course, as you say, Mark, they've only got a short-term commitment at the moment. So there's a real possibility that Red Bull end up with no engine and then someone has to supply them. And of course, which is manufactured with leftover supply? Well, it's Renault or Ferrari, isn't it? But also, there's no sign of that longer term commitment, which then could build the kind of thought processes, culture, collaboration that you really need to try and take on this mighty Mercedes machine. And of course, as you mentioned, Mark, this is actually a really good test of the whole style of organisation Mercedes have built, with Cal moving on and Toto possibly as well. They've banked on having this team that can not rely on individuals, that has people ready to just step in at a moment's notice, even while those people are still there. If people need to take holiday or leave, you just seamlessly carry on. If Mercedes can have built the thing right, they should continue being as good as they are now. We'll see really the power of the individual versus the machine. It's a massive challenge for Red Bull and Max, considering everything we've just talked about.
I suppose when we talk about commitment, we should clarify that the people on the factory floor who research, design, build, do all that sort of thing in Honda in the engine program are, of course, 100% committed. It's just the people several layers up the food chain who have their hand on the tap of money are not necessarily quite so committed, because they've, you know, they're feeling the wind blow from different directions, aren't they? Because it's a challenging market at the moment for the automotive industry, and certainly no one really knows where the internal combustion engine is going to fit into the mix in the coming months and years. Whether we will see some sort of ICU integrated in powertrains on road cars, or whether we're going to swap to full electric powertrains, that's still not quite clear, is it? Some manufacturers are going all in on electric, others still sort of think the hybrid is the way to go for the foreseeable. So I suppose the higher levels at Honda are wondering, you know, where culturally they're going to go over the next 10 to 20 years, and whether Formula One will follow that direction.
And bringing it back to Max, I mean, what's he going to do? I think, to bring it back to the feature, he's driving better than ever, I would say. This year, he looks like he's absolutely ready to take on Lewis Hamilton for the World Championship, but he doesn't have the car. And the big question is, now he's missed this one deadline, if you like, set by Helmut Marko, does he stick it out with Red Bull Honda and hope it comes good? Because obviously, he's still got plenty of time on his side. But as the years tick by, eventually you wonder, you know, will he peak too soon? Will he waste the best years of his career in uncompetitive machinery? How can he get himself into a position where he can challenge for the World Championship? And it's just not clear at the moment.
No, it's an extraordinary situation, because essentially when we have a conversation about Max and Red Bull and what happens if Max gets frustrated, and of course we saw in Mugello just how angry he can get, to the point where you have Red Bull saying, well, you know, we're going to sit down with Max and explain to him what happened. So that you can see there's a little bit of a power shift there. Max, clearly a very frustrated beast in that car, and unhappy with what is essentially pretty disastrous outcome for him compared to the rivals that he wants to beat. But the question of where does he go next? Well, he certainly wouldn't want to drive for Ferrari, even if the opportunity arose. I don't think that he will see McLaren with a customer Mercedes engine as necessarily a great place to go. Who knows? You know, where else is there? Renault? I mean, it's we actually have a Formula One which it has itself as a sport in a quandary, because you can take a great talent like Max Verstappen or any other great talent you'd care to mention, and frankly, unless they're behind the wheel of a factory Mercedes-Benz car, they're not going to win World Championship titles. And so once again, it comes back to the fact that 9 of the 10 teams are not doing a good enough job, and they all have the reasons why, and some of them are structural, some of them are technical, some of them, you know, maybe leadership wise. Fact remains, none of them are as good as Mercedes, and that perhaps really should be the my final point on this as regards Max, which is that when Lewis eventually, together with Toto, announces his new deal, which will be a 2+1, maybe that becomes Max's goal, that actually he waits for the 2+1 to run out 2 years, and then maybe Lewis stops. So Lewis might stop at the end of 2022. That's not that far away. He might take it into 2023. Who knows? Maybe we will have one season where a new arrival in the form of Max Verstappen is competing against the 38-year-old Lewis Hamilton in his final year in Formula One. What a prospect that would be. You know, realistically, if you were, you know, Max's manager, you'd be saying, there's actually only one car at the moment in Formula One that we should leave Red Bull to get into, and that's got it's got the three-pointed star at the front of it.
Perhaps with Yuri Vips snapping at his heels in a Red Bull. Or is the Yuri out on that one?
Well, terrible puns aside, there's an extra challenge there, actually, because Toto Wolff's admiration for Max is quite well known. And of course, when Red Bull initially signed Verstappen, there was a bit of a bidding war going on between Red Bull and Mercedes to get Max. And of course, at that time, Red Bull could offer him graduation immediately to F1 because they had Toro Rosso at their disposal, whereas Mercedes, they didn't have a junior team. They could fund him into GP2 maybe and see how it went. They didn't have a seat, obviously, in the works team. So Max went with Red Bull because he could get into Formula One faster. And he feels, obviously, loyalty to Red Bull for giving him his big shot. You know, he's engineered himself a good position there, you know, lucrative new contracts, etc. But Mercedes have always kind of dangled this possibility that he could go there. But speaking to Jos, who obviously co-manages his son, at the start of this season, just after Max has signed his new deal, we talked about this idea of, well, Mercedes is the place to go if you really want to win. It seems like they've got it sewn up. You know, alongside Lewis, you'd have a bit of a dream team there, a kind of Senna, Prost at McLaren, you know, window of opportunity to see the two best kind of going at each other in the same equipment. But Jos said even if Bottas was out, even if Mercedes could make room for Max, how could they afford both Max and Lewis in the same team? And that was before coronavirus hit and everybody had to start tightening their belts. I mean, I still feel like with Lewis's new contract, there's going to have to be some compromise there from him in terms of salary or bonuses or how the whole thing comes together, because surely even Mercedes, as mighty as they've been, don't have the same budgets available now that they might have done last winter. And certainly I can't see, unless there's a massive recovery over the next 2-3 years, them having sufficient budget in the future to, with the budget cap, I know salaries are exempted from the budget cap, but the budget cap represents this idea that you try to do everything for much less than you did before. How will they justify, even if they wanted it, spending massive money to get Max Verstappen out of Red Bull into Mercedes alongside the sport's most successful driver ever, who commands the biggest salary of all the drivers on the grid, and quite rightly.
I mean, let's face it, Max has earned a great deal of money already. And if he was to go to Mercedes-Benz on a trajectory, you know, let's call it a 5-year contract, where he comes in on one number and by the end of the 5 years he's on 3 times that or whatever. So it's a very, very nice number over a period of time. Lewis Hamilton is going to phase out of that team at some point. And I think, I mean, Jos is a fairly bloody-minded individual. Money will be important to them. But actually, I do fundamentally believe that Jos and the manager and Max, the only thing that they want to do now is to win the Formula One World Championship. And I think given, a tough negotiation with Mercedes-Benz, I could see in 2 years' time them bailing out of Red Bull, going into Mercedes-Benz, as I say, coming in on maybe a slightly lower number than they would have ultimately liked to have gotten. But if they have a 5-year contract and a trajectory towards earning the vast sums that ultimately someone like Max can earn as a multiple world champion in this sport, that's the team to do it with. And it's going to be really interesting. I think, you know, there's lots of stuff ahead in this decade that's in front of us, including the fact that Helmut Marko and Dietrich Mateschitz, the owner of Red Bull, you know, will be heading into their ninth decade, actually. And what's going to happen to Red Bull as a team, as the owners? The structure of the sport seems like it'll undergo some shifts again, going to the way in which electrification is taking over and other forms of powertrain. And this makes it quite a minefield for any driver planning where they're going to get to in the years ahead.
Well, suppose we have one driver who's hoping to get to somewhere in the year ahead in the form of Sebastian Vettel, who's made a big ticket move in the past month. What do we make of that? I mean, I know we're sort of jumping a little bit forwards in our list of stuff we were going to talk about, but obviously Sergio Perez has been thrown under the bus by the team he saved. And we're going to tackle the Vettel to Aston Martin implications in more depth in next month's edition of GP racing. But what do we make of Sebastian Vettel and where he sees his next few years? Because as we've discussed in previous editions of this podcast, he's not someone who necessarily is in Formula One for money. He's in it or because he can't think of anything else to do with his life. He wants to be in a winning car. So is this a big ticket gesture of faith in what Aston Martin are bringing?
I guess it must be. I think it's a mixed picture. I suspected, you know, when it looked like Vettel was gradually on his way out of Ferrari, you know, when they were looking at signing Leclerc up to a long-term contract in the kind of middle of 2019 and things hadn't been going very well for Vettel, he'd missed his championship shot, you kind of felt, well, this is the end of Vettel's era at Ferrari. What's he going to do next? And of course, he's won 4 world championships. He's one of the most successful drivers ever in Formula One. I was wondering to myself, will he just bow out, realizing that, you know, the star has waned and he's had his time, had his success, just leave on a relative high, not quite that season, but, you know, reasonably successful period, and just go off and do other things? Or will he be a bit more mercenary about it? Will he be more like his mate, former teammate Kimi Raikkonen, and just keep going? You know, if the money's there, if someone's prepared to pay me to race their car, I love it enough that I'll just do it. You know, I'll park my pride about being a multiple world champion race winner, have to be in a top seat, this, that and the other, and just keep going. Of course, Kimi, still going into his 40s, may well continue next year. It's the career that never ends. And I feel like with this move, Vettel is kind of almost on that Kimi path. It's obviously a much more competitive proposition than moving to Alfa Romeo or Haas, particularly at the moment. But nevertheless, he's not going to win races, I don't think, next season in that rebranded Racing Point team. You know, he's going to be competing for podiums, possibly similar to where he is now with Ferrari, maybe a bit better, maybe not, depends how the token system plays out for Ferrari. And then, of course, the big gamble, as it is with Alonso at Renault 2022, will everything shake up? I guess for Vettel, he's thinking, well, if the rules do what they're supposed to do, then you could be in almost any team and have a good shot. But, I mean, pessimistically, I feel like that's wishful thinking. I mean, the last time they changed the aero rules drastically, Mercedes got further ahead, if anything, not pegged back much. OK, Ferrari gave them a fright, but, you know, they were still on top. And, of course, the engine rules remain the same, and it still feels like at the core of it, and related to what we were talking about at the top of the show, it's that project that Mercedes got the head start on, that they've kept building on year after year after year. How is anyone going to peg that back, even if downforce is taken away and cars can follow a bit more and the tyres are a slightly different compound and the wheels are a different size? I don't see how that's suddenly going to transform Racing Point, who, okay, there's investment there and they're expanding, but they're not going to be anywhere near the scale of the teams Vettel's used to. I don't see how they're suddenly going to jump in a season's time into championship contention. So to me, it feels like Vettel is just keeping the flame alive, mainly because he loves racing in Formula One, loves the speed of the cars, and he can get paid a decent whack for doing it.
I see it as an overwhelmingly positive thing for Sebastian, for the team, and for Formula One. And I mean, let's start with the most important thing. I mean, he's going to have a great company car, isn't he? I mean, an Aston Martin DB11 is pretty cool to have. There's a nice meme going around on social media last week of...
he won't pick a boring SUV, you don't think?
No, I don't think he'll take the SUV somehow. I think the DB11 would suit him very well. But there's a nice meme going around social media last week of Sebastian dressed as James Bond, looking pretty cool behind the wheel. But actually... all joking aside, the reality is that he's going to work for a company that's having a lot of money put behind it in the form of Lawrence Stroll's purchase of Aston Martin and then the investment in the Formula One team. As per my column in Grand Prix Racing last month, the relationship between Aston and Daimler is a very close one and is only going to get closer. And there's every reason to believe that Toto Wolff and Mercedes-Benz, including Brixworth, will only be too happy if they can further help that team to progress, because the provision of Mercedes-Benz engines to the Aston Martin road car range, being reflected in the fact that the Aston Martin Formula One car has a Mercedes-Benz engine, means that there's a lot of business-to-business going on here, which is very beneficial. And I think I said in my column, you know, if Lawrence Stroll was promised by Mercedes-Benz, we will help to get you to P2 in the World Championship, I think he'd be a pretty happy guy to see that happen. And for Sebastian Vettel to win just one Grand Prix for Aston Martin next year would be, you know, 23 years later, just like Damon Hill winning that one Grand Prix at Spa for Jordan Grand Prix, because there are a lot of people who are now saying, interestingly, well, Sebastian only won four World Championship titles because he was driving the best car in Formula One at the time. Never mind the fact some of those championship battles were absolutely colossal, and he was up against the likes of Fernando Alonso and the Ferrari. But I'm sure that for Sebastian, he would love to put to rest the fact that he could only win in a Red Bull by going and winning a Grand Prix in an Aston Martin. And if you have a race such as we had in Monza, where for a variety of reasons Mercedes-Benz trip up, there will be a Sebastian Vettel opportunity. And I suspect he'll jump in that Aston Martin next year, enjoy the power and the performance and the reliability of the Mercedes-Benz powertrain, and put himself in the position of being the man most likely to win a Grand Prix should Mercedes-Benz trip up. I think he'll be giving our previous candidates on the podcast, I think he'll be trying to give Red Bull a hard time. And, you know, if you have Sebastian Vettel qualifying third row of the grid, second row of the grid, maybe in the odd occasion, just putting himself in that position, I think that could be great. Now, all of this assumes that what we're going to find is a rejuvenated, re-motivated Sebastian Vettel who doesn't make some of the basic mistakes that we've seen in the last two seasons. I have a hunch that he will just feel in a better place. And I think if he can relax this winter and come into a team that's got both arms wrapped around him and loves him and wants him to be successful for them, I think he will be a new man. And, you know, his benchmark in the team is Lance Stroll. Now, no disrespect to Lance, but if we get into the next season and Sebastian is struggling against Lance, we know that there's a problem, that we will know there is a deeper problem there in terms of him. That's not to say that Lance is not a very good driver. He clearly is a very competent racing driver. But Sebastian, to lead that team to championship, to race-winning success, not championship-winning success, which is likely out of their reach, but to race-winning success, he will need to rediscover some of that famous Vettel speed.
It's interesting you bring up the topic of the relationship between Mercedes and Aston Martin going forwards, because obviously in this issue we've taken a look at the thorny issue of customer cars, clones, and sort of traced the trajectory of that argument over the past 14 years from its beginnings when Red Bull turned up with its little clever way of circumventing the wording of the Concorde Agreement to have one company supplying two teams, that being a little bit naughty, various shenanigans occurring in the years ever since. And now we have the scenario where Racing Point, soon to become Aston Martin, are fielding what's basically a pink last year's Mercedes and not really getting the most out of it, I suppose, is we could quite easily say, you know, it's obviously not a turnkey solution, cloning a car. But in the course of constructing that feature, we decided it would be a good idea to try and map out where the alliances were between the various teams using the form of Venn diagrams. And we love a good Venn diagram on GP Racing. And yeah, we've lumped Racing Point in with Mercedes because there are ties between those companies sort of at senior level, aren't they? We've seen someone go from AMG to Aston Martin Road Car Company. And although the two share different ownerships, it is fascinating to see where the relationship between those teams is going over the next few years.
On the customer cars thing, well, I was very impressed with this piece of work. I think it is among our host's finest pieces of writing, trying to draw together all the various strands of quite a tortured, long-winded, acrimonious debate between all organisations in F1 itself, the FIA, definitions of what Formula One is, the essence of it, the DNA of it, if you like. And the thing I found very interesting about the story is that it's the Concorde Agreement and the various iterations of that, the recent, most recent of which has just been negotiated to its conclusion that ties the whole thing together. So you have all these organisations coming in with slightly different ideas of what Formula One is and how they want to do it to their own advantage, both competitively and financially. And that ties into how they develop their relationship with Formula One, how they extract their money, how they go racing. And it's been, the dial has been moved throughout these various negotiations, allowing more collaboration and sharing of parts, and then back the other way, and then more the other way again. And now it seems perhaps back towards what we might consider, and what Frank Williams, who opens Stewart's piece, might consider the traditional way of doing Formula One, which is that you do everything as far as you can in-house. Of course, it's not going to be fully that way, because otherwise the relationship, the increasingly cosy relationship between the likes of Mercedes and Racing Point / Aston Martin, or Haas and Ferrari, Alfa Romeo and Ferrari, wouldn't work. And of course, that's the reality we have now in Formula One. People trying to do it cheaper and to save costs. Formula One obviously realises that the more of a car that you can source from one place and not have to invest loads of pointless R&D into yourself is a great way to save money and deploy it somewhere else. But of course, that goes against the grain of how so many Formula One teams and owners have grafted their way up from scratch in the past. I'm not sure it's been fully resolved, but it's a very interesting question, quite fundamental to what Formula One is, and the whole Racing Point cloning pink Mercedes situation, which now seems to have been resolved without going to court, kind of has raised that whole debate into the spotlight again.
Yeah, the whole customer car debate's been going on for so long, and I must admit that my view on it changed over the years. I used to firmly believe that it was essential that every team effectively created its own car from scratch. And then, you know, I mean, even back in Jordan days, we were doing our own gearbox in-house, and we would, you know, we'd source the engine outside, but we would do everything else. But as the years have gone by and our sport has gone through cycles of crisis, you know, the tobacco sponsorship crisis of 2005, the technology crisis back in the 2000s when some of the big technology sponsors in the sport disappeared overnight, financial crisis of 2008, now COVID, you know, and there have been others as well, that every time we go through a crisis, we end up talking about how can teams survive and how can we ensure the long-term stability. Now, a lot of groundwork has been achieved this year with the budget cap, with the Concorde Agreement, more equitable sharing of prize money, so on and so forth. I think our sport has grown up enormously under Liberty's ownership, quite frankly. There's been a much more adult discussion about how do we protect the franchises, which effectively are what the teams now are. They are now effectively protected franchises. As we know, there's now a $200 million entry fee commitment for anyone new wanting to come into Formula One. That's led to cries of derision from some saying, you know, we should be able to encourage new teams into Formula One. Actually, no. What we need to do is to protect the existing 10 teams in Formula One through thick and thin. And if an Audi or a Porsche or a Toyota wants to come into Formula One in the future, they are going to have to partner with one of the existing teams. And I think, frankly, that should always have been the case. I honestly think Toyota would have won Grand Prix if they had gone into partnership with someone in the 2000s instead of trying to do everything on their own and Cologne the Toyota way. Well, the Toyota way was the failure way. They'd never succeeded. So the whole question about teams and stability and long-term has been addressed, I think, in a very adult way. The reality is that there is a dilution within this of the full constructor capability, where you can now buy in the engine, which, let's face it, is a huge number of systems, and the transmission. So the entire back end of your car, you can just go and buy it in. And that does dilute some of the purest constructor ethos of Formula One. But needs must. And I think we have to achieve this more adult approach to ensuring that teams large and small can survive in this sport. And my final sort of thought on this was that I had certainly come to the view a few years back that fully customer cars should be allowed. But if a fully customer car were allowed, so in other words, you could simply go and take a Ferrari or a Mercedes, that you could only run them if you didn't compete in the Constructors' World Championship. You could only compete in the Drivers' World Championship, and there would effectively be two prize funds, a prize fund for drivers and a prize fund for constructors. That's not going to happen. We have moved way on past that conversation now, and I think where we've ended up at is a pretty elegant solution for Formula One going forward.
Because you had the first, the Formula One World Championship has been a kind of a game of two halves, hasn't it? You had the first 30 odd years where pretty much you could turn up with whatever car and claim your starting money. So you'd, in the 1950s, you'd have Peter Collins in a green Ferrari, entered by Tony Vandervell, things like that. You'd have different coloured cars. You'd have Carroll Goddard de Beaufort turning up in his yellow Porsche occasionally. And then you had companies like Cooper, Brabham, McLaren, who their whole ecosystem was they built their own cars, but they also supplied other people. And there was nothing unusual in seeing, say, Frank Williams turning up with a Brabham, a 2-year-old Brabham with a Cosworth engine in the back. That was how it was for a while. But as Formula One became a televised sport, you can't just have people turning up when they please and bogging off when they can't afford it. You people don't engage with that. So I suppose the thing in our feature is we point out that the Concorde Agreement bound the competitors into the championship because you had to commit to it if you were going to be on TV. And then, of course, they wanted to protect their R&D spend, which was fair enough. And that's how you get into a position where you have McLaren, who started out as a constructor selling cars to other people, now being adamantly against the idea of customer cars because it dilutes all the services and the investment they have in that lovely factory that they're about to sell and lease back.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it, that Formula One's now become ring-fenced, I think is the word that you used in the news story explaining the franchising system, Collins. And that's what's happened. It's a bit like, it's not identical to, but it's a bit like the football Premier League in the UK, where you say to the 20 teams in there, right, you know, you will share all this TV revenue with you, and we won't bother really so much about the other teams in the lower leagues, but we might let a few come up from time to time on a promotion and relegation system, which has been suggested in Formula One too, from time to time. Of course, in Formula One, the barriers to entry for new teams exist there already, in that everything has got so complex, so expensive, so difficult to do, that people are put off and have been for decades from trying to do Formula One. I remember when periodically the, you know, new teams are being encouraged to join Formula One thing came up around about the time Haas joined, asking Trevor Carlin, who obviously ran and still does one of the most successful, if not the most successful, junior single seater teams to come out of the UK, you know, why not you? And he said, well, the money he would need to invest to be able to compete with teams that have invested for decades in infrastructure and built up over time, and all the knowledge that those people have acquired and then transferred in from other teams, he'd need astronomical sums of money that probably even Lawrence Stroll couldn't lend him. So there's just no point doing it. And then you end up in a situation where, you know, likes of Max Mosley tried to say, right, we'll have a budget cap then and you can come in and we'll give you some dispensations to help you compete. And that attracts a few chances, but they're not structured in the way of a traditional Formula One team or even a current Formula One team. So they're never going to be able to compete properly without those kind of massive changes in the rules. And really, we've now reached this kind of place where I think Formula One's kind of accepted that what we've got is what we've got. And Haas were the only team that could come in as a new team and be okay because of buying as much as possible. That's upset a lot of people. Some have tried to copy it, as you would expect, because they've seen a shortcut to success. And then your traditional competitors have kicked back against that. And now we've kind of settled into a, right, well, let's try to keep everyone happy, freeze where we are. The pandemic's hurt us a lot. the Concord Agreement, the new one, works very well for the existing teams because, as Mark says, it protects their value, creates a new barrier to entry. And really, that, I guess that's kind of a sensible way to go, because there are only a few organisations out there that could really commit to the kind of spend you'd need to start a Formula One team almost from scratch or from scratch and come in. And it's not realistic anymore. So really, you're better off shoring up your existing teams. And if somebody really serious with a huge amount of money wants to come in and be the 11th, well, then they can put their money up and pay all the existing teams for the privilege, and then we can have 11. But that's not what the Formula One teams are going to want, because it dilutes their value. And even, I remember Gene Haas, even after he only shortly come into Formula One, you know, as a new team, and people were asking him, I remember doing an interview with him saying, well, you know, shouldn't we try to grow the grid more, have more competitors? You know, the instinct for fans is to have more teams and more drivers. And he was vehemently against it, because, of course, he knew down the line, if he could establish his team, an 11th or 12th would just dilute the amount of money he could make from being in Formula One. Now, you've kind of got your official limit. And when these 10 teams are already, some of them, really up against it financially and struggling, particularly because of coronavirus, they really cannot afford for an 11th or 12th team, however well funded or not, to come in and dilute their prize money pot further.
There was a story last week in the wake of that particular sort of $200 million headline figure appearing. There was a story about a team, Panthera, trying to come into Formula One in 2022, and one of the partners in that team was quoted as saying, you know, they believed that they could get into Formula One for, it would cost about between $80 and $120 million to create a Formula One team, bring it into Formula One. And when I read that quote, I thought to myself, well, you've just answered your own question here about why Formula One needed to put the $200 million tag on it, because anyone who thinks you can come into Formula One and compete with an upfront investment of $80 to $120 million has no idea about Formula One. Formula One, you need to have the money necessary to compete in Formula One for at least 3 years and to spend at least 18 months preparing for that. So you need a 5-year set of funding to be able to come in and compete. And the sport should have zero interest in 11th and 12th teams that come into the sport to participate. We're not interested in participants. We want competitors. And I'm sorry, but if you've only got $80 million, you need to go and do something else. Go and do Le Mans. Go and do the WEC. Formula One is not for you. And I think this puts an end to that conversation. The other thing is, if you've got $80 to $120 million, which you were going to allocate to create a Formula One team, which by all accounts you don't really understand how complex that is, take it to a team that needs investment. You know, go and see Frédéric Vasseur and the shareholders of Alfa Romeo and say, actually, I'd like to buy 30% of your Formula One team and I'll put in $100 million. They'd probably have a very positive conversation with you. Similarly, Gene Haas, I'm sure he would love someone to come and help him with the heavy lifting of running Haas F1. So again, I come back to my point that this is a very elegant way of shoring up the stability of the 10 teams that, I think, to a man, all exist to compete in Formula One, and be it Alfa Romeo with Frédéric Vasseur or be it Williams with their new owners. Everyone in this sport, I believe, wakes up every morning dreaming of winning. And those are the people we need to protect. And the partnerships that have developed between, whether it's Renault and McLaren with engine partnerships, or Alfa Romeo, Haas and Ferrari likewise, I mean, that's just part and parcel of the structure of our sport going forward. And it just helps to make sure it all remains on sensible footing.
Yeah, and of course, if there were more engine manufacturers able to produce competitive power units to the hybrid regulations and provide them at a reasonable cost, then you wouldn't have so much of these political alliances, because a lot of, as it becomes quite clear in the various Venn diagrams, it's built mainly around engine supply, isn't it? The Mercedes-aligned teams are aligned with them because they have to be, because they use their engines, transmissions, and in some cases suspension components. And it's likewise with the Ferrari teams, Red Bull and Honda and AlphaTauri and Honda, apart from obviously common ownership. If there were more engines available, you would have more independent teams within the 10. So that's probably the next thing that may be addressed, if they can come up with a decent set of regulations for 2025 and beyond, and finally encourage some new suppliers in. But that's, you know, a bit like with new teams joining the grid has accepted. Like the horse has long since bolted the stable on this, hasn't it? You know, trying to get new teams in, it's far, far too late to lower these ridiculously high barriers to entry without fundamentally undoing the existing teams you have. And we're kind of probably reaching that same point with the engine manufacturers. You know, there was a great effort made to entice the likes of Audi in, you know, those stories about a partnership with Red Bull a few years ago. Porsche were on the committee looking at the engine rules, because obviously, you know, at a certain level the WEC is much more affordable, but at the LMP1 level, as the rules were when Porsche were doing it, and of course Toyota just now at the kind of end of that road, the budgets were similar. So, you know, Porsche could have done Formula One with its LMP1 budget, but chose not to because they didn't feel like that was going to give them the right return. So how you entice, if you can't develop a set of rules that can get, you know, these massive manufacturers with huge racing pedigree into Formula One, then something's wrong, isn't it? But whether we can wind back to a point that would get those manufacturers to come back, I don't know. I mean, it feels like, you know, something died after 2008 and we might never get it back.
Yeah, the absolute state of LMP1 in Le Mans last weekend, I mean, that's veritably a cigar that's been smoked right down to the stub, and it's time to put that category out to pasture. I mean, we're coming up past our hour now, so we probably have to sign off, but I don't think we should leave before wrapping up the subject of Williams, which is very much bound up in what we've just been talking about, because here was a team that was tricky to place in our Venn diagram, because of course Mercedes aligned politically but very much against the whole Racing Point clone scenario, and very much Claire Williams, now no longer the deputy team principal, always adamant that the listed parts issue was a problem because the manufacturers had been diluting it and allowing teams like Haas to come in and just basically buy kits and assemble a car off the shelf, pretty much. That team, I would argue, and I know there's a lot of the fans, people on Twitter have been very much against the $200 million bond, saying it stifles competition. But I mean, I would argue that this has saved Williams because it enabled them to be an attractive investment for new investors. Those Dorilton Capital, the people behind it, just would not have spent any money on that team whatsoever if it didn't have a franchise value gifted to it by the bond. And I would pretty much say that has been the saving of the team.
Yeah, I think that plus the budget cap will definitely have played a role. And I think those, you know, the Dorilton Capital conversations that took place over the summer unquestionably would have focused on, you know, what lies ahead the next 5 to 7 years for Formula One and for Williams. And it's kind of played out beautifully, I suspect. I think, I mean, lots of people were online saying it was sad and tragic about Frank and Claire. It's not sad and tragic to build a company that was super successful for 4 decades and then successfully sell it to a group of investors who want to take it on, and by the way, call it the same name going forward and keep all those people employed. There's nothing sad about it. It's a huge achievement. And, you know, Claire and Frank and everyone involved in that process should be applauded for what they've done in terms of that succession planning. I've no doubt that personally and emotionally, it'll be a sad moment for Claire and for Frank and for those who are good friends with them. But from a purely business perspective, this was a fabulous outcome. And as you say, Stuart, those fundamental financials of Formula One will have made sense for Matthew Savage and Darren Fultz, who are the two guys who lead Dorilton Capital, and also for the new director. I mean, so they've both been appointed directors of Williams. The third new director is James Matthews, former Formula Renault champion, son of David Matthews, who was a touring car racer in the UK back in the 70s. Matthews family love their motor racing, no question about that. And James is Eden Rock Group, which is based in Mayfair in London. You know, he's been brought in by Matthew and Darren to bolster the board and unquestionably bring a lot of know-how to play there in terms of know-how, business know-how is what I'm, I suppose what I'm referring to, rather than necessarily Formula One know-how. So that team has really, that team has benefited from this sale in terms of the way that board of directors now looks. And clearly that shake-up is going to continue through this autumn. I don't think the new owners have any intention of coming in and just sweeping a whole layer of management out the door. But the fact that the chief executive is gone, that Claire has gone, that Frank has gone, Simon Roberts has been made interim team principal, shows that we're now seeing the next steps being made since the Dorrelton takeover. And I don't think people should be too frightened about what's going to happen with Williams. I think the new owners will want to enter 2021 with a good period of stability and to start understanding what this business needs. And going back to a point I think that Ben made earlier on in the podcast about McLaren, McLaren went 3 years of denying that there was an internal problem. I think Williams actually had gotten to the point of understanding they had an internal problem some time ago, and Claire has talked about that recently. So the new owners now have a chance to put that right, be that people, structure, organisation, systems and processes, relationship with Mercedes-Benz in terms of making the most out of that powertrain supply. So I think overwhelmingly it'll be positive, and it's a good outcome, I think, for all concerned, particularly the staff and the suppliers at Williams.
Ultimately, it's good to have racing people who happen to be minted involved in it, because there's a well-worn maxim, a maxim as well-worn as a pebble in a river, which is that the quickest way to make a small fortune in motor racing is to start off with a large one. So when you have people who are good at business and know their racing onions, you would have to hope that the future is at least a little bit more settled for that team. It's, and if cultural change needs to be exacted, having new people at the top directing it from above and instituting those changes gives it the best chance of success. So more on that, I suppose, in the next issue of GP Racing, where we also take a look at, coincidentally, actually, our multi-part history of the Williams team also comes to an end in the next issue of GP Racing, doesn't it, Ben?
Indeed, yeah, it's almost like we read the tea leaves, isn't it, some months ago.
It makes us look really clever, whereas actually it's all...
it's complete dumb luck. We could never have dreamed. But it's not before time, is it? It's the right time for us to do the full history of Williams, and it was the right time, I think, for the Williams family to kind of sell up and move on. I mean, for the good of the team, at some point you have to kind of get out of your own way, don't you? If you look at the success of a team like Team Enstone, which has gone through various different identities and ownerships, that operation still exists because people have sometimes it's been mismanaged, obviously, but they've got in and out. It hasn't been stuck with one identity that must remain forever. And it's to Williams' credit that they were able to exist as they originally were for so long and do so well. But as Mark said, for a while, Claire's been saying and realising that that team has some fundamental endemic problems that can't be easily addressed. And they go back almost right the way to the 80s and 90s when Williams were at its most successful, because there are certain ideas, processes, cultures, ways of doing things that are just way, way out of date, and you can't change them like that. And you can't necessarily change them if you are the same people who were running the team when those processes were cutting edge. So having a new broom sweep through and new owners coming in who are, have some racing people at their heart and are sympathetic to everything that's gone before and want to protect the organisation and the good parts of it, is probably for the best. Williams gets to keep the history and the identity and remain in Formula One, but probably become more competitive than it might have done if everything had just stayed the same.
We wish the new owners well. More about that in this edition of GP Racing and the next one, as we digest the implications and see what's happening. I may have mentioned in passing that the October issue of GP Racing is on the newsstands now. Visit gpracing.com to get some fantastic subscription offers. We will be in the same place at the same time next month. all that remains for me to say is thanks very much to our poor, benighted, long-suffering producer, Martin, wielder of the scissors. And thank you to my guests, Ben Anderson.
Thank you, Codders.
Mark Gallagher.
Thank you very much.
And thank you all for listening. We'll see you all again next month.